We're going to try to reach people. Why is it important that we understand their culture? Have any thoughts? That's exactly right. We have to know where they're coming from, their background. If you're going to try to get the message to them, you want to get the message to them in a way that they can understand. 1 Chronicles 12:32, speaking of the, says, "And the sons of Issachar, men who had understanding of their times to know what Israel ought to do." To understand the times in order to know what to do. And so that's the reason. Now in this, today I'm going to be giving you, trying to, a lot of stuff about our culture. We're not doing a Bible study. You've got the Bible, you can read it, and it's very, very important because we want people to see the biblical base from what we do. But we're trying to understand our culture. And so I'm going to start back and try to give you some things about our culture, because the people that are arriving on the scene that you're trying to minister to, they weren't just born yesterday. A number of things have affected them. They're where they are because of some things have happened to them. That's why they think like they think and this type of thing. So let me give you a little bit of just culture. We're going to go all the way, not back to the beginning of the earth or anything like that. But let me just start like at this point. Before 1929 in America, before the Great Depression, everybody in America basically worked hard. And you just worked and made a living. We had the great, great middle class in America, and that was greatly honored. Today, to a large degree, it's looked down on. Everybody wants to get out of it. But then that was what most of America was. And people worked hard, and you just expected to work hard. That was just part of the deal. Along came but one great hope that everybody had. Everybody hoped that we would be better off, they would be better off than their parents were. And you go back from the history of America, every generation had it easier than the generation before, just because of the technology and all that had developed. Well, we've got a group of people on our hands right now that do not necessarily have the hope that they'll have it easy, better than their parents had it. For the first time in our history, this has never been a time in America when one generation didn't think they'd have it better economically than all the generations before. But the little house that Mom and Dad paid $28,000 for out in California in 1940 is worth, you know, $300,000 today. And even with both of them working, they're not going to be able to afford the standard of living that Mom and Dad had. And that's deeply affecting some of the people that we're ministering to. But when the Second World War came along, we really put a tremendous effort in this country into the war effort. We built great factories, we made bombs, we made war materials, we did everything we could, and we sacrificed in America. The whole nation sacrificed to try to help win that war. I'm 56 years of age, and I can even remember as a boy wanting a little metal cap gun, or a little metal gun for, not even a cap gun, just a little metal toy gun for Christmas. But there weren't any metal guns in America for Christmas because all the metal was going into war goods. And I got a little gun that was made out of, I guess it made out of sawdust glued together or something. I know you drop it on a piece of concrete and it'd shatter into 1,000 pieces. And I can remember we walked quite a bit because you didn't want to drive because they had rationing of tires and even sugar and things like that, because we were putting our effort into winning the war. And when we won the war, there was a tremendous sense in America of just excitement, upbeat. And when the men came home, we had something in America that we had never dreamed about. We had what was known as the great baby bust in America. In fact, is the 6 years, in 6 years after the war was over, we had more babies born in 6 years than we had had in the previous 30 years in America. In 1 6-year period, more babies born than had been in the previous 30 years. And the reason for that is we hadn't yet had the women's movement of, "We don't need you men, we're going to go out and conquer the earth." That hadn't started. When they came home, there was a great sense of prosperity. In fact, from 1940 to 1950 in America, salaries tripled in one decade. And so as a result of it, there was a great sense of expectancy in America. Everybody wanted to get married. Everybody wanted to have children. Now, we didn't have the large families, but everybody was having babies. I mean, everybody got married and had babies, it seemed like. And so we didn't realize what this was going to do in America. I mean, America was tremendously, has been changed ever since that time. But we had this baby boom. And so the baby boom, the boomers, what we call the baby boomers, are those that were born from 1946 until 1964. Many of you in this room were born during that time, from 1946 to 64. That was a great baby boom years in America. Over 4 million babies born every year. Just to let you know how unprepared we were for this in America, as far as all of our, you know, the demographics, the people that figure out all these things about population and all that, is really interesting, because GE had 226,000 employees. And so they decided that they would give, they would give 5 shares of stock to every baby that was born in the family of someone that worked for GE. Now remember, they had 226,000 employees. And their anniversary was in 19, and let's see if I remember correctly, I believe in 1952. And on the date that that company had started, it was their 75th anniversary, they decided every baby born to one of the members of our employees, we'll give them 5 shares of stock. So they had to figure out, the company did, how many shares of stock we got to hold back to give these kids. Well, they talked to demographers, people that figure out populations and all that kind of stuff. And so they decided, come right on in. They decided that year that there would probably be 13 babies born on that particular day. Now, you know how many babies were born on their anniversary that day? They thought there'd be 13. They had 189 babies born that day. Well, that was just an example of what was happening. When the baby boomers bust started in this country, the city of Los Angeles added 1,000 new school teachers every year, more than it had the year before, and could not keep up. We built, in the first year or so, when these when they started going to school, we built 226,000 new classrooms in this school and had over 280,000 classes of kids meeting in storefronts, in churches and other things, because we just could not provide for this humongous herd of babies we had on our hand. Did you know that in 1957, 1 out of 10 Americans was eating baby food? I mean, that became one of the biggest industries in the earth, was Gerber's baby food and some of these. I mean, just, it was phenomenal what had happened. Now remember, the people before had gone through the Depression, the war, and they just thought, our kids are not going to have it as hard as we had it. I remember hearing that. My mom and dad used to tell me that. My dad went through the 8th grade. My mom had to move away from home and live and work in order to finish high school. And I heard that growing up. We can't give you boys much. And my brother and I were the first ones ever in the history of our family to be able to go to college. They said, we can't give you much, but we want to help you to go to college. Now, let me just stop and say something here that I think will interest you. Our generation was very, very knowledge conscious. I mean, we would go to a conference when I was in college. If there's a conference on Christian life 300 miles away, we'll drive and go. I mean, we were the knowledge conscious group. We were the notebook carriers. We were the note takers. Why? Because that's the only way you got out of where you were. That's the only way you got off the farm and slopping the pigs. You had to learn something. And so we were very, very knowledge conscious. And that's why conferences, in the early days of the NAV conferences, and I remember Leroy Iams talking about back many, many years ago, and just, I mean, just packing out Glen Eyrie for conferences and things like that. I remember in about the early 70s, probably 73 or somewhere, Bill Gothard, the first time the Bill Gothard Institute I went to, And we took 103 students from the University of Oklahoma. They'd get on a bus at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, drive to Dallas, go to the conference, get back about 1:30 in the morning, go to class the next day, and we had 103 to go. Now, in the 2 or 3 weeks, Bill Gothard's going to be at First Southern Dell City, and there won't be 12 students from OU go. I mean, it's a whole different ball game. We have got a new generation on our hands. You look at the quality of this conference and think, we got 250. You know, you think, why don't we just pack it? Well, we've got a new generation on our hands. They've grown up with the knowledge explosion. When you have an abundance of something, it's not precious to you anymore. See? I mean, you don't think about the amount of water you, ladies, that much. You're not real conscious about the amount of water you use in your kitchen. But if you carried it 5 miles in buckets, you'd be very, very conscious of water. But now you're not very conscious of water. If you get up in the morning, you take a shower, and then that day you go out in the yard and you get all sweaty and need to do something, you go take a second shower. But see, you wouldn't be doing that if you'd carted it in and carried it 3 miles in a bucket. See? So anytime something becomes very, very precious, it's no longer as important. Well, these kids grew up with knowledge. I mean, you look around, they're not note takers. They're not hungry like the group was before. And so anyway, now let me just go on here. Okay, so we've got all these kids coming on. When they started hitting the schools, we weren't ready for them. I mean, they started through school, and that's when we began to have, they have forever changed America. Because in the first place, people began to say, we don't want to raise our kids in the cities. Do you know it's really after the Second World War that we had the tremendous growth of the suburbs? We don't want to raise our kids in the city. Let's go out to the suburbs. Well, when you move out to the suburbs, then it's when we started being two-car families. And then when television came on. Now, I'm 56 years old. When I was 9 years old, when I was in about the third grade, do you know that you could buy a brand new Chevrolet car, brand spanking new Chevrolet car, cheaper than you could buy a black and white television? When I was 9 years old in 1945 in America, it cost more for a black and white television, just an old black and white television, humongous. I mean, the tube may not have been that big, but the thing was, it cost more than a brand new Chevrolet car. Now, I heard Paul Harvey saying that the other day, 1945. Well, I figured out I'm 9 years old in 1945. Now, when they got to school, all of a sudden we had these herds of kids. I mean, you talk about kids. Now, another thing. After the Second World War, we had all these factories we'd been sacrificing for the war. Well, we got all these factories, what are we going to do with them? Well, let's start making consumer goods. So we started making consumer goods, and with about 7% of the world's population, we were consuming about 70% of the world's goods that were manufactured in the whole world. You talk about becoming consumers. We became consumers. And somebody said, let's see if we can make consumers out of these little kids. Well, I mean, we did. The best food, the best clothes, the best toys. I mean, you can walk in any kid's home, any one of you here, if you have kids, you can go into your child's room, and there are more toys in that room right now. And even if he's only 2 years old, he's already got more toys, probably, than I had from the time I was born till I graduated from high school. I mean, that's just true. I mean, toys, the best of everything. And so when these kids started growing up, they were told, you're special. We don't want you to have it as hard as we have. I mean, the best of everything. I mean, the best of toys, the best food, the best health care. I mean, everything, the best. And we told them, you're special. And so when they got to school, there's so many of them, we began to deal with them in herds. Boy Scouts became a big deal. Little League, all of this kind of stuff started growing up because we had so many of them. It wasn't just, you know, I mean, every school was overrun. The classes were too big. Just now, something else began to happen. The children, the greatest influence in their life began not to be their parents, but their peers. And they began to run in herds. You know, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, clubs, all this kind of thing. And so then when they started, and all of a sudden, now it's been fine. They've been told all their life back at home, you're special. You've got the best of everything. But then when they began to get to school, and especially in the latter years, then there began to be great competition because you got to go to college. And the colleges were absolutely overrun. For every one professor that retired, we were hiring five new ones. I know when I came to the University of Oklahoma in 1967, the university was growing at the rate of over 1,000 students a year. Well, any university today that's holding its own is doing well. And right now, there can literally be 100 applications for one slot at the university. I talked to a fellow the other day. He's got a MBA, and he applied for a job. There were only 110 applicants for this one job. And so I'm telling you, it's a different ball game. Now, when we still didn't realize what was going to happen in America. These kids, there's competition in the school. We've told them you're special. If you want to major in art, major in art. If you want to work, son, whatever you like. Daughter, whatever you like, just do it. If it's underwater basket weaving, well, you want to major in it, fine. Okay? And then all of a sudden, they're going to hit the job market. And one good thing about it, a lot of them were in school for a long time. And we still weren't ready for when they hit the job market. They hit the job market. And then all of a sudden, we're not ready to absorb the millions of kids that are coming into the job market. And so what do? They can't get jobs. And so let's go back and let's get another degree. Let's postpone things. And these people are basically called now, both the busters and the boomers. The boomers and the busters, and we'll talk about the differences in a minute. And these people came in to the job market. They couldn't get jobs, so they go back to get another degree or something. One lady wrote a book called A Postponed Generation. I'll give you a bibliography later, in which she says that a kid today that's 28 years old has a maturity of an 18-year-old of 30 years ago. And that's true, basically. When I graduated from high school, back in the mid-50s, when a person graduated from high school, you moved away from home, very shortly thereafter. A lot of people got married shortly thereafter. They moved away. You got a job. You didn't live at home. If you were 28 and living at home, you were mentally retarded or something. There's something wrong with you, really. Most of the time, if you were 28. Do you know now, today, today, 75% of the people in America that are between 25 and 28 live at home? Now, I'm not talking when I say a 28-year-old has the maturity of an 18-year-old. I'm not talking about intellectually. They know a lot more because they're exposed to so much. But I'm talking about emotionally. And so they became the postponed generation. They're postponing everything. They're postponing marriage. Like, here's a lady. This happens all the time. Here's somebody. They're 28 years old. She says, yeah, I want to get married someday. She's 28. Or here's a lady that's 35, and she says, yeah, we want to have kids someday, but I'm not ready yet to give up my career. She's 35. You think, lady, that clock is ticking, But, it's postponing. You're going to see this a lot with the kids. To the options. They're overwhelmed with options. Did you know that back in the 30s, if you wanted a Chevrolet, you had two choices? You could get it black. The first choice was black. And then they had two choices, I think, black or blue, wasn't it? That's the only two choices of colors you had. Look at the options today. So kids today are into options. Options are a big, big deal. And that's why I could go back to the University of Oklahoma and I could tell our students, I want you to hold 2 years from tonight. 2 years from tonight, we're going to do this. We could announce it in every meeting, announce it every day, every single time we ever had a meeting. 2 years from tonight, 2 years from tonight. You know what? If that afternoon, here's this kid that's known about for 2 years, if a better option came along, he would take it. They don't want to make commitments. It's what's the best option. That's why I think I'm the most lied to guy on the campus. I've gone to doors and knocked and visited with students, tell them about, BSU or freshman ministry team or something, and would you come? They said, well, I'll probably come. And I know when I walk out the door, he's probably lying. But even if he planned to come, he won't make it definite. because he's going to wait and see what other option shows up. There may be something that he'd better like to do.
I thought it was me always.
But that's the way they are. Now,
well, even if they do, if something else comes along, oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
Flip you off.
See, and I'm amazed. Here'll be something, and you're going to have this, and then so-and-so is in a concert in Dallas tonight. So they drive to Dallas and spend $35. I mean, see, that just amazes me. Because when I grew up, it was you made a commitment. Like my dad was a Chevrolet man. Now, you go back and talk to some of your parents, and you'll find out your dad always drove a Chevrolet. Or he always, and my uncle drove a Ford. And I can remember at family reunion, Dad, when are you going to get rid of that old piece of junk and get you a real car? And I mean, that's the way they were. They were committed. Dad was committed to Chevrolet. My uncle was committed to Fords. They would never drive anything but a short Ford or Chevrolet. People just, you made commitments. There's a grocery store in town. Dad knew the guy. He bought his groceries there. Now, if they were giving groceries away two blocks away, Dad wouldn't go down there for anything. And I remember when Miami won the NFL that year and won the Super Bowl and all that, and Zonka and those guys jumped and went to the World Football League, you know, that started and collapsed. And those guys left and went with that. And I thought, you rascals. See, they got bigger contracts. I thought, you're not loyal. I mean, don't you care about what happens to the team? Because, see, I always felt like you made some commitments. I mean, if you reminded me it often, you were mine. You didn't just leave because somebody paid you another million. I mean, and see, that's what you'll see with the sports teams and everything today. I mean, it's just like, what's his name down in Dallas? Emmitt Smith? Really has a loyalty to the Cowboys, doesn't he? Yeah. I mean, hold out. I mean, who cares if you lose the first two games? See, there's no loyalty to the Cowboys. He's getting all he can for himself. Well, see, that's hard for some of you, especially older, to understand. I mean, we have a hard time understanding the kids today. Okay, these kids hit the college campus. As they go out, they try to get jobs. A lot of them can't, so they come back. They're getting degrees, you know, second degrees, and there's a very tenuous whole thing about their life. Now, I want to give you a sheet, and the first one, let's see, I wanted you to have the one, thought I had all four, yeah, here we go. Take one of these, if you will, and this is called Just Understanding Our Culture. Most of this you'll see on the back of it is from the book, The Invincible Generation. I've listed that over here, but let me just quickly give you this survey. The seniors were those that were born in America before 1926. There's about 39 million of them. That's about almost 16% of the U.S. population are what we call seniors. And then the builders, those who were born from 1927 to 45, that's a group I would fit in. They're 43.6 million, about 17.5%. These people were not born with a spoon in their mouth. They were intent on making America, they were interested in building a better life, a more comfortable lifestyle. They were interested in America being, doing well economically and militarily. We heard statements like, I don't want my kids to have it as hard as I had. Now, the baby boomers were those that were born between 1946 and 64. Some of these things we've already said, 4 million, they were special. Great expectation generation. Now, let me stop here at this point. There's always been a sense in American culture where the rich had a safety net under them. I mean, I know where I grew up. There's one of my friends. His dad owned an automobile dealership. When he was in high school, he'd have a car. If he wrecked it, no big problem. Just get another one. See? The rich have always had a safety net under them. They've always had great expectations. But let me tell you, in recent years, anyone born in America has had great expectations. Because it's now, we expect it. Like if you want to start a riot at a university, not a riot, but basically, you'll see them marching, and any time they talk about raising the tuition, you're going to get a rise out of the students. You know one of the reasons why? Education is no longer a privilege. See, even when I started school, it was a privilege to be able to go to college. So whatever amount of sacrifice you had to do And I know by the time I was 6 years old, I had $50 in the bank account that I'd saved, because even back early, you saved to go to college. I was riding with a kid that's a freshman at OU this year, back from Glen Eyrie. And I was riding in a car with him. We'd spent some time up there in the summer. He had just finished his junior year. It was the summer. And he's got one more year before he goes to school. He's planning to come to OU. I said, how much money do you have saved? Do you have saved? He had not one red cent. But he's planning to come to OU. I mean, there's a sense now in which it's no longer a privilege. It's a right. You owe it to me. I was born in America. You owe me a college degree. Now, remember this. Our president is a baby boomer. Do you see that? See, for the first time, the baby boom generation was the first time in America people did not just have to work to survive. I mean, you had to work to survive. We had a survival mentality. You had to work to survive. The baby boomers were the first one in the history that didn't necessarily have to work. I'm talking about when they were younger, have to work to survive. And see, we have a baby boom president. Like, we're going to have it all. I mean, we're going to have health care. We're going to have everything, anything you can ever want, we're going to have. I mean, now, where we can pay for it or not is not an issue. That's not an issue. See, it's just we're going to have it. And so you can see this and how it's affecting America today. Now, so that's the first generation that did not have to be concerned about economic survival. College degrees and full-time work for women became common. More comfortable life due to technology, and then on the back. And we're going to spend most of our time here talking about the baby busters, those that were born from 65 to 83. Now, the group that's 9 years old and younger, nobody's named them yet, to my knowledge. I don't know what to call them, just kids, I guess. But we don't know yet what the patterns are for them. But those that were born from 65 to 83, there are basically three groups of them. They're kind of grouped in three. They're a little bit different. We're going to talk mainly about the older group, those that are 22 to 27. But the baby buster's really a misnomer. Sound like, you know, something bust, there's not much to it, but that's the second largest group. It's just that there were no longer 4 million of them. There are about 3.4 million born during this time. But see, that's they're all 27% of the U.S. population. Do you know there are more baby busters in America than there are a lot of nations of the world? There are more baby busters just in America than there is the total population of Canada. Now, homogeneity is gone. I mean, used to, you could, you know, kids were kind of raised in a community. They were very much alike. And due to the influx of immigrants and due to the aberrant philosophies, the different lifestyles, all of this, we no longer have a homogeneous group. They may be something of the same age, but they're very different. You know, and something else that I learned that really concerned me is this here. Earning their loyalty never ends. See, my dad drove a Chevrolet. He just liked it. So Chevrolet had him hooked, you know, for years and years and years. He finally got an Oldsmobile before he died. But, I mean, he was just a Chevrolet man. But, see, these kids, I mean, kids today, they don't care. They may have a Honda in the driveway and something else. They don't care. They want what's the best thing for them. And that's not bad necessarily, but you're going to be working every day to win their loyalty. You don't just win a kid's loyalty and you've got it. I mean, you may think you have his loyalty and you've got him for this Monday night Bible study, but then something else comes along on Monday night and you're constantly working at winning loyalty. It's not easy. You don't just get it and you've got it. Now, I'm not saying that some won't make a commitment to you. We're talking about any time you have to talk pain in broad strokes. There may be some exceptions, but basically this is the way they are. George Barna says, busters have not committed themselves to build character through achieving spiritual depth, and they seem to lack the emotional stability and endurance to withstand the battle of wills and values. They do not have a culture, music, fashion, or heroes of their own. This generation that's in college today, 22 to 27 years of age especially, they do not have a culture. See, with the baby boomers, your group, it was rock music. Well, with them, as rock plus some classical plus some others, and probably rap more than anything, but they don't have a particular music. They don't have particular fashion. I mean, there's not a particular clothes fashion. You look back on the clothes they use, they wear some of the boomer clothing or some of the other. I mean, it's just kind of a mixture. They're real unsettled. There's not anything from this group that's kind of settled in. And part of that is due to their age, but part of it, too, is this, well, like heroes. They don't have heroes of their own. You'll see on one of the other papers when they were asked, who's your hero? The person that got the most votes was Ronald Reagan, and he only got 8%. And they don't know the difference between a hero and a famous person. You know, like used to in America, a person was considered a hero that did usually something heroic over a long period of time, or it may be in battle or something like that. But usually a person was not given a hero status until he lived a quality life over quite a period of time. And so they don't know the difference between a hero and a movie star, or a hero, and here's somebody that's got a beautiful voice. And so they're all of a sudden, you see, Garth Brooks or somebody like that might be a hero. Well, I mean, what do you know about his character, about his life, or something like that? See, they don't even know the difference between a hero and a famous personality. And leisure is no longer a privilege, but it's a right. It's no longer just a privilege to have leisure. I mean, that's they think they own it. They have no sense of ownership over their lives. They live in a world dominated by boomers. And so these are just some things that I thought might be helpful to you. I want you to look also at some of the felt needs of the baby boomers. You know, if a person feels a need for something, like if he feels a need for scripture memory, it's a whole lot easier to get him to memorize verses if he sees a need for it. And so one of the things that I want you to see is just take a few minutes to talk about some of their needs. One is belonging, a sense of identity. They want a group, not an organization. You'll find out that it's harder to get them to make a commitment to, quote, the navigators, or commitment to anything. For example, and this is true of the boomers, and it'll certainly be more so of the busters, for example. See, when I grew up, if you were a Baptist, you were a Baptist. I mean, I didn't go to the Methodist church. I mean, I was a Baptist. But let me tell you what's happening today. Here's a couple. They get married. And they let's say they both like music, and hey, I hear they have a good music program over here at the Methodist church. So they go to the Methodist church. And maybe that goes on, and they have a little baby. And they hear somebody else over here has a tremendous children's program. And it's over at the Baptist church. So let's go over to Baptist church. So they go over to Baptist church for the children's program. And then later the kids get on up, and maybe that church is not doing so well. And so there's a independent church over here. And boy, they got a tremendous youth director. So let's go over to that church. Now remember, we started after the Second World War trying to make consumers, to use these factories to do everything, to give everybody jobs. And we made consumers out of them. So that's what we've got on our hand. We've got a group of consumers. And so they're not loyal to your organization. They basically look at you about, what do you have to offer me? And when you quit offering it, buddy, I'm going somewhere else. Now see, that's hard, because some of us, especially the older, we think of loyalty. You make a commitment to a group, and you're loyal to that group, and you take your lumps with them. Well, they're not very committed to anything. It's just whoever's got the best deal. It's kind of the cafeteria thing. You know, I like some of this. If your church has got this, I like this. But, I mean, now don't ask me to come Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. I mean, you know, I know that's what Baptists used to do, but I like this, so I'll come to that, but I don't want this, but I'll take that. And so they're very, very consumer-oriented. Now, understanding and unconditional love is one of their needs. And let me just say this, don't criticize them before you try to understand them. You know, it's very easy, and of course Jim was saying that so good about what he said about Jim Peterson and others. It's easy for us to look at them and be very, very critical. But they had a lot of things that influenced them to get where they are. And so try to understand them. They need a lot of feedback. If you're working with them on the job, they want to know how they're doing. I mean, even if it's something that they're doing wrong or critical, they like feedback. because they're pretty insecure in some ways, so they want to know where they stand. They want to own it and personalize it. If they don't, they won't rebel, they'll just ignore it. They don't have to be rebellious. See, some of your generation, if you're a buster, was rebellious. You rebelled against some of your family values. Now, for example, see, the seniors and the builders knew what traditional home life was like. I'm not saying all the homes were good, but at least Dad made the living, Mom stayed in the home, they knew about home values, and we ate meals together and things, okay? When you come along, you busters, come along, so your parents were going to provide for you, and they begin to work, and especially now, when the boomers get to work age, both Mom and Dad is work, so it's no longer just absentee Dad. And see, that's one of the reasons I hated to see the American farm go under. The small American farm, one of the greatest places in the world to raise kids. Because Dad was around, Mom was around, they're home for meals, they were around. There's even that child growing up. I know when I grew up, man, you had to feed the chickens. You had to gather the eggs. There were things for you to do. I mean, if you're six, you had duties. You learned some responsibility. But then, see, when the farms began to close down, and even after the war, I mean, we still had the farms, but when men go off to factories, and now with the American farm going under, the man is away from the home. So he's not around the children as much. And then when Mom went to work, too, we don't only have absentee dads, we have absentee parents. Okay, the kids that are on the college campus today, a lot of them don't know the traditional family values. See, if you're a boomer, you knew them to a lesser degree maybe than the builders and the seniors, and you may have even rebelled against some of them, but most of the boomers have not even passed that down to their buster children. And so they don't have it. They don't know what a family is like. They didn't grow up where you ate meals together and things like that. They don't know what it's like to have Mom at home, so many of them. They don't rebel, like I say. If you don't let them have a part of what you're doing, it's not that they'll rebel against it, they'll just ignore it. And that's why you can plan the best thing in the world for them. But if they don't also feel like they have a little part in it and it's theirs, they won't come. It's just not theirs. They don't have to get mad and rebel. They just ignore it. They have no respect for authority. Can you imagine why they wouldn't respect authority? Because the greatest authority figures in their life, most of them have been very disappointing to them. This is the divorced generation. Over 40% of those kids came from broken homes. And so as a result of it, they... authorities in their life, those that they most loved and most trusted, have failed them. So they've lost some respect. And so you walk into their life, want to get this kid in Bible study, think he's going to respect you, he's going to jump at it, he's going to start on three verses a week. He's not, probably, because he doesn't have that kind of respect for you. Significance. They long for purpose and significance. They want to feel significant on the job, not just work. They're not interested in just working. They want to feel significant. Training. Share your life with them. Now see, this comes down to some of the things, if you've been around the Navigators, you've believed for a long time. And that's one thing that's so needed, is share your life with them. You know, as Paul talked about 1 Thessalonians 2:8, we were willing to share not only the gospel of God, but our own souls or lives, because you had become very dear to us. They need that. They need time with you. They need time, not just programs. Many of them kind of need reparenting. They want to be around. And they're interested in being around, if you'll show an interest in them, someone that's older. They're tired of talk. They want to live it. They watch it, participate in it. You know, it's interesting because some of the old line denominations have begun to experience some problems. Like, for example, Southern Baptist with a cooperative program. Some people think, well, it's the reason we may be having it's down a little bit is because we had a fuss in the convention over the authority of the Scriptures. I don't think that had anything to do with it primarily. The point of it is, and when it was started in 1925, in 1925, if I wanted to help missionaries, I had to give through the cooperative program, because out in the community where I was, I'd never seen a live missionary. Nobody went on mission trips. But today, see, it's nothing unusual. People in your church go to Brazil for a 10-day mission trip. So people are going out there, and one of the good things about this generation, they want hands-on. They're not interested in just contributing to some big organization. They want to know the missionary. They want to know, they want hands-on experience. And we can really use that. They're tired of talk. They want to have a part. They want to participate. Experiences. They say they have a short attention span, 2 to 7 minutes. And you say, well, what do they do in a lecture, 45 minutes? Well, they phase in and out, don't they, Brent? I mean, they don't sit there and catch everything that goes on for 45 minutes. Because they grew up, everything is short. They've even put hidden monitors on dads. And have you read how much time the average dad spends talking directly to each child? Have you seen some of those reports? I mean, it's less than 15 minutes a week. A week? Does that surprise you? I mean, literally where the dad is actually talking to the child. I mean, really communicating with the child. And so everything is done short. I mean, even every life problem. I mean, they've grown up on TV. I mean, for the baby boomers, what was the babysitter? 23,000 hours watching television. Now, as a result of that, he is, every problem can be, the longest it takes to solve any problem is 2 hours. I mean, right? I mean, the movie starts, the whole thing's solved, it's over in 2 hours. I mean, it's instant everything. They want instant potatoes, instant everything. I mean, now, see, it was the baby boom generation. You're the ones that got the Pampers. If you had kids earlier, we had to wash diapers. But no, you get the Pampers. Throw them away. Instant. We want everything easy. Everything instant. We're a visual generation. They like creative ways. That's supposed to be drama instead of drums. We had a little computer problem. You're going to find a few misspelled words, but at least you can figure it out, I think. We focus so much on the cognitive. For them, it needs to be active. Like I was talking about, we were the generation that wanted to go and take all the notes and the big notebooks. They've grown up with knowledge, so knowledge is not precious to them. They're not going to pay a whole lot and usually go to a conference, see. And that amazes just to think the difference, like the Bill Gothard Conference, 103 driving Dallas. Now it's so easy, so accessible. But they don't want knowledge that much. I mean, they feel like it's running out their ears. Now, maybe not the right kind, but they're not hungry, in a sense. Fact is, this generation, the baby boomers, you know why they go to college? The number one reason, it's an evil you have to go through to get to do what you want to. Basically, it's not because they're hungry to learn. Now, I'm not saying that kids aren't studying today. They are. And don't, like some of you that got out of college, you don't want to start over again because they are having to study. And I know someone asked a professor at the University of Nebraska, said, what's the difference between getting a degree in 1980 at this university in 1990? He said, well, in 1990, it's about twice as much work as it was in 1980. Now, it's just, they're having to study. And see, for the first time, they're running scared. See, when the first baby boomers started to come along, everything had been good in their life until President Kennedy was killed in 1963. Nothing ever in their history had ever been traumatic. It might be something personal in their family, but not as far as a nation. And that's why you ask nearly any baby boomer, where were you when President Kennedy was killed? And he can tell you where he was when he heard that news. Can't you? Because that was one of the most traumatic things that had ever happened in their life. And so they can remember that.
Information has doubled, tripled in the last 5 to 3 years.
It does. It doubles about every 3 years, I understand, something like that. So it's just phenomenal. And so, but anyway, these are some of the things that are going on in our society. And if you don't understand this, you're going to have trouble in trying to know the people. They need small groups. They need a place to open up. Now, this R, if you would just mark, this baggage needs to go under that, and that ought to say relationships. One of the needs they feel is for relationships. Now, why would you think they felt that need? Because growing up, what didn't they have? They didn't have relationships. Mom wasn't there. They were the latchkey kids. Dad wasn't there. And just to think about it. See, another thing, fact is, I would recommend that you men especially, if you've not done any reading in the area of masculinity, you ought to read a fellow by the name of Hicks's book. I know at the big conference they had in Colorado this summer up with Promise Keepers, That book was given out. I was not there, but I've read it. It's on masculinity by Hicks. It's an excellent book. But see, the children today, so many of them, when a divorce comes, usually they go live with their mother, right? So you think the divorce rate of anybody married since 1990, there's a 55% chance they'll get a divorce. So that rate is high. So when you think at least 4 out of 10, and it's closer probably to 5 out of 10, that is one half of those kids on a college campus, were not raised with their dad. They were raised, and so when mom's there, and then who's their babysitters? Mom, you go to a nursery school, who are the ladies there? Mom, who are the first grade teachers, second grade teachers, third grade teachers? They're women. So men are very, very confused. And then they hear all this stuff, you need to be sensitive. See, we want you to be sensitive. Why? Well, certainly there needs to be some sensitivity, but we've tried to make men exactly like women, and they're frustrated. Because because all their life they've just been, the only influence basically they've had is women. So, I want you to notice, the baggage from their father or their parent will be carried over to their leader, and so therefore discipling sometimes is painful. Sometimes they're going to react to you. They're not just reacting to you, they're reacting to dad, or you told them to do something, and a lot of time when dad told them to do something, it may or may not happen. And so they don't know where you're coming from. There's some distrust there, and it's hard for some of them. Okay? Those are some felt needs. Okay, let me take this sheet on the characteristic of baby boomers, and we'll hit that. Here are some characteristics of them. They're the entitled generation. The college is right and out of privilege. They like to play, lots of toys. They've had everything basically handed to them. They don't like the Mac jobs, that is the McDonald's or Mac whoever else, a $7 an hour because there's no prestige. So used to, you got a job, you made a living for your family regardless of what you had to do. I mean, they may go, and see, they know for the first time in America, you don't have to work. I mean, you don't. There are too many people that don't. And, you know, we're going to have food stamps, we're going to have all this and that. And they've gotten the message, you know, you don't have to take that $7 an hour job, just have a job. And it's sad. They don't want to climb the corporate ladder, they want to ride the elevator. They don't like this, they're not interested in coming into your company, making a commitment. So there was a time if you started work for Conoco Oil Company, guy would work there and then maybe retire. Now, I'm not saying nobody ever changed, but a lot of time a person come in, start at the bottom, work his way up. They don't want to start at the bottom. They don't come in wanting to know, you know, to get started and work their way up. They don't want the ladder, they want the elevator. They come in wanting to know, where's my office? They wanting to know, my son, I mean, he's one of them. Everybody's son is one of them. But he's working this summer. He's working on a master's degree at the University of Texas. So he goes in and he tells his boss, well, this is a summer job. I don't think you're using me very wisely. Well, see, I mean, most people 10 years ago, you might have said that after 5 years, but you don't go in a week and tell them, I don't think you're using me very wisely. I think I could do more than just, well, see, I understand it's there, but that's the way. They want to be significant. They don't want, I mean, they want to be in on decision making. They want to be a part of it. They want to be a part of the process. And that's just the way they are. That's not altogether bad. But see, you're going to find, too, those of you that have worked with them, they're going to ask a lot of questions. Why? Like one guy said, this girl drives me nuts. And somebody said, well, why don't you fire her? He said, well, let me tell you about it. He said, well, how's she driving nuts? Well, she always wants to know why. You tell her to do something, why? Well, see, those of you that are older, you had a sense of authority. If your boss asked you to do something, you just did it. You never thought about asking why. I mean, he told you to do it, did you? Well, they don't think that way because they don't have respect for authority. You ask them to do something, they want to know why. They also want to know what's in it for me. And see, we can really react to that. So that's selfish. Well, it may be, but that's where they are. And so they want to know why. So he said, well, why don't you just fire her? And he said, because she knows too much about how to run that computer. So they have valuable skills, but they're frustrating. And if you're talking to businessmen who are starting to work, the baby busters. The baby boomers were bad enough, but the baby busters, I mean the workplace, is it's very, very frustrating. They're going to have more flexible hours and a lot of things because they want to be a part, and they don't. Now listen, this group, now the baby, a lot of the baby boomers, they started working harder. They are the ones that produced the yuppies, those that really went at it, some of the workaholics and things like this. This group does not live to work. They only work to live. And they will change careers 7 times, they're saying now, in their life. I mean, I know students that are with good companies. When you ask them, how's it going? Well, I don't think I'll be here long. I don't know, as I've talked to any one of our graduates in the last year or so, that thinks he's going to be there forever. I mean, it's, well, this is fine for now. But they don't make commitments to the company. It's whatever's best for us. Remember, they're consumers. What's best for me? This will look good on my resume. This will give me some good experience, and then I'll move on here or there. So don't think they're going to come into your company and have the sense of loyalty that maybe you might have had. They want satisfaction without, write the word out in there, without sacrifice. They want satisfaction without sacrifice. They are the now generation, buy now, pay later. They want everything fast. They like options. We've talked about that. Short-term episodes, like if you're going to have Bible study, and instead of saying you want to be in this Monday night Bible study this year, because see, he's thinking, well, Monday night, we may be playing Kansas one of those Monday nights in basketball. Or he may think, I may want to take my wife out to eat one. So you might say, we're going to have this month Bible study every Monday night for a month. Now, if you miss it once, you missed a fourth of it, but let's go for a month. And at the end of the month, see how it's going, then you can crank up for longer periods of time. But commitment probably needs to be more stair-stepped. They're the disillusioned generation. They've heard the talk of the atomic bombs and all that. Of course, that's a little bit over, we hope now. But AIDS, homelessness, they've become apathetic, pacifistic, ambivalent. They're unwilling to tackle problems they didn't cause, so they carry some resentment and anger towards your parents and baby boomers. They say, listen, a lot of you people are going to be retiring. They're going to be less than a job force. We're voting everything. You know, we can have everything now. You've gotten us humongously in debt. There's going to be fewer of us working to pay for it. You're the one got the hole in the ozone layer. I mean, you're the one messed up the environment. And I mean, look what the inheritance you're leaving to us. And so really, there's a lot of them kind of carrying some resentment. Now, I'm not saying that you can talk to a baby buster and he'll sit down and tell you everything I'm talking about. I mean, he's not thought it all through. But there are these currents that you're going to find in their life somewhere. They're the postponed generation. They're dragging out adolescents. 75 or so, 18 to 25, still live at home. I may have said 25, 28 a while ago, but 18 to 25 still live at home. A 28-year-old has the maturity of an 18-year-old. That's in the book. If you want to read the book, Postponed Generation, it's very enlightening. It's not a Christian book, but... And they put off important decisions. They're the lonely generation. Remember, the baby busters were going for it. I mean, the baby boomers. We're going to go for it, the job. If I have to move to Chicago because of a raise, a lot of people did that. So there was high mobility. They're lonely. They even listen to music alone. I mean, do you see them? It's so funny to watch most of them jogging. They got their Walkmans on. I mean, now, your generation went to concerts together. These people listen to music alone. Now, they may go to some concerts, too, but there's a loneliness. A few role models, we've talked about that. They're slow to establish relationships. This next one relates to dating. They're really uncomfortable in the dating scene. They don't know exactly what to do. They've not. They'll kind of give come on signals sometime, and then when you kind of come on, then they push you away because they don't know how to build good relationships because they didn't build them. They didn't build one with Dad. They didn't. You know, maybe they've seen him 3 times in the last 6 years, and or something like that. You know, because Dad walked out when they were 3 or something like that. And then Mom, you can imagine a mother raising a child alone, the difficulty with that. So they really had some problems with Mom. And so they've not built good relationships. And then when there's this humongous crowd growing up, they just weren't good at relationships. Synergistic generations, totally comfortable with contradictions. Like, for example, now this will amaze you. See, when I was growing up, if something was right, the opposite of that was wrong. See, like, to be faithful to your wife was right. To be unfaithful was wrong. Premarital sex was wrong. See? But with a lot of them, it's kind of like you can say, Jesus is the only way, and I believe that. Somebody else says, Buddha is the only way, and they say, I believe that. I mean, here's the same person, he believes both of them. I mean, he doesn't see a contradiction. And it just kind of blows you away. Now, wait a minute. If Jesus is the only way, then Buddha couldn't be a way. Well, no, they can believe both. I mean, it will amaze you at the contradictions. I mean, that we think are contradictions. And see, it's like Francis Schaeffer talked about that. One time we had thesis, antithesis. I mean, if this was right, this was wrong. But then we had something in America called synthesis. We mix them. Like, we grew up thinking premarital sex was wrong. Well, not if you love each other, or not if you're going to get married, or unless we may want to get married. We want to try and just see things work before. And so there's that kind of thinking. You're going to find that. And because of the fact, remember, this generation raised by the baby boomers, many of them had kind of rebelled even against some of the traditional. As a family began to break down, the home values, so they don't have these values. See, Francis Schaeffer said at one time a girl could be walking out the door to go on a date, and you could say to her, be a good girl, and she knew what you meant, and it made sense. But he said you can say to some kids today, be a good girl when she is out on a date, and that's a nonsensical statement to her. That does not make any sense at all. Because she doesn't have the idea, some things are right, some things are wrong, it just kind of depends. Folks, this is scary, isn't it? But let me tell you, it's going to get worse. And we need to know. Five main values: leisure, recreation. They love to have fun. They work to live. They don't live to work. The family, people value what they've missed. They long for stability. And the main reason they want to get married is they want the family, they want marriage for companionship. There was a time in America that it was an economic thing, wise thing to be married. I mean, you know, 75 years ago, people just got married because that was basically security and thing. They're not looking at it that way. I mean, the main reason is they actually want the companionship. So see, there's some good things about that we can really build on with these people. They love freedom. They want experience. They want to feel God. In other words, they want it to be real. They're not just interested in doctrine. They want relationships. A random encounter with adults will have little impact. Time is needed. They don't have much time around adults. They didn't have much time around their parents. They long for relationships, but they're ill-equipped to build them. It's interesting, the things they most want in life, they're most ill-equipped to have. They want family, but they don't know how family ought to operate, so many of them. See, they want a meaningful job, but some of the older managers and people just don't want to work. The fact is, they've been, and you find this in our society, trying to talk retiring people into retiring later to stay and work because they don't want to have to hire some of these kids coming on because they don't know how to relate to them. Because if you don't understand them, they'll turn you off. You think there's no commitment, there's no anything. You go tell them to do something, they want to know why. And see, the rebellious generation could ask that more as a rebellion question. And so if you don't understand them, you can have some real, real problems with them. Now, let's look at some insights for ministry. We're to be out of this session at 3:30. Okay. Here's some of the things that might be helpful. And a lot of this, and I've given on another paper here that I'll give you credit. A lot of this comes from George Barna and also from, I was out at recently at USC, and then we have a good friend at Irvine, and he'd gone to some conferences out in California where they've been talking about some of this. So some of these ideas have come from different places. But establishing relationship, the key to winning their trust is establishing relationship. They've experienced much rejection. They've been let down by those they trusted the most. So spend time with them. Listen to them. Find out their hurts, their hopes, their fears. And it's not that they're not open to the things of God, because they can be very open. But you need to hear them. establish a core. They want to be a part of a decision-making process. They want to know why. They want to know what's in it for me. They want to have fun. Keep messages short. They get bored easily, but challenge them. Keep things laid back and unpredictable. Even in your meetings, like with the team of guys I meet with on Monday, I don't always want to do the same thing. I want to sometimes do something that they would never suspect. Because here again, their interest, they're the visual generation. Did any of you read Piercing the Darkness or This Present Darkness? Or you know how you look in any Christian bookstore now, you go down there and you see one of the big things is novels. Now see, 10 years ago they weren't novels. I heard Peretti talking on one occasion. He said, the reason I wrote that book like I wrote it, and if you've read it, you know how it is. And then Bodie Taney, that series of books, Covenant series and all that, they're excellent. But both of those books, the outstanding novels today, and outstanding, here's the way they write. There'll be about a page of this. And then meanwhile, it's like the old Westerns, meanwhile back at the ranch, you know. And so they jump from situation to situation. And Preddy said, I was speaking at this camp, and I'd get up there and preach, and his kids sitting there like that. So he said, I began to tell stories. And he's very personable, you know, and animated. So he said, and I'd tell him his story, you know, and he'd get them to a certain point, and then he'd stop, and he and then these kids sitting there listening. And so he'd tell Bible stories. And he said, they're raised, this is the video generation. They're raised on TV. Things are exciting. There's action. There's not just sit there for a lecture for 45 minutes, see. And so that's one of the reasons they seem to have so little interest, some of them, in church as we know it, because it's boring to them. I mean, man, if something doesn't happen, like one kid, this literally happened. And this kid, and my mother was telling me about it, this kid, this lady, brings her kids to church. And I don't guess a kid had ever been in church in his life. And so he sat there a few minutes and he said, Mom, let's go home. This show ain't no good. And I mean, he said that in church, you know, because to him it was boring. And so we've got to watch that. Keep things kind of laid back and predictable. They grew up on TV, MTV action, so don't give them dull church meetings. Don't expect long-term commitments at first. They aren't volunteers. Remember, they're in a survival mode. They're not sure how it's all going to turn out, and they're trying to survive right now. They don't have a lot of things figured out, and they're trying to survive. Their focus is on himself. Establish a relationship and let them know you care about them. Be relevant. Be transparent. Be spontaneous, not glib in answers. See, they love to do spontaneous things. Hey, let's go to a movie. See, you'd think now to call somebody, like if I wanted to call Ralph and Val and say, hey, let's go to a movie, we'd think, well, we probably should ask him last week. Boy, not this generation. I mean, if we're going tonight, it's probably too early to ask them. Wait another couple hours and then ask. I mean, they love to do things spontaneous. Isn't that right? You know, and I found it. I even kind of like that. You know, just, let's do it. Yeah. Yeah, that's the best way to get them. If you'd told them 3 months ago, there wouldn't be one of them here. Now, they need to see how you use what you teach. In other words, now this is a practical, they're very pragmatic. They want to know how does it work. See, now that's great. Rather than you giving them 14 things the Bible says here, here's one thing that you can apply to your life. And they're best reached through friendship evangelism, not confrontational outreach. Why? Because they resist authority. You come at them, well, the Word of God says. And see, we use a word. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying here. I'm talking about your initial, like when I first came to University of Oklahoma, we let a lot of people, Lord, just go and knocking on doors. We don't now. Because I just found that that doesn't work nearly as well as it once did. Because the way people are coming to know the Lord is when a kid gets him in a Bible study or he's on his floor, and he plays for him, and he works with him, and he eats with him, and he plays basketball with him, and he brings him to BSU, and it's usually over a period of time. And see, that's what you know out in the work field where you are. So we're going to have to, some of the very training you've had, like from the Navigators, is going to put you in tremendous stead for the future if we can just make some adjustments and realize it won't be everything exactly like we used to do it. See? But the principles of relationship, sharing your life, getting to know them, doing things with them, praying for them, loving them, helping them. See, those are the very, very things that they that they want and they need. Don't expect them to respond well to a ministry designed for boomers and builders. See, that's one of the reasons we have some of the problems in our church. Most Southern Baptist churches, and I can speak from that because I know more about it, are built basically for elders and builders. That's the way they were designed, because that's where they came from. Okay, then we got the boomers. Okay, a lot of churches, and that's why, I'll mention the bibliography later, but we need to be learning. And see, there's like Willow Creek Church in Chicago, and I'm going up there this month just to look at that thing. And see, here's the largest church in America, started, 11 years ago, and they're reaching boomers because they saw they won't normally. How can we reach the non-Christian? And there's a new book out, but one of the men reached by that called Reaching Unchurched Harry and Mary. Be worth your reading, I think, because a lot of insight into non-Christians. Leo Strubel is the name, the man that wrote it. Inside the mind of unchurched Harry and Mary. Something like that. That's close enough, it'll get it. Now, I have a friend, went to California, they started a baby boomer church to try to reach the boomers. They did reach some boomers. And he's working with college students, and he said, now we've found out that the busters don't like it. And so they're having to do some things for the busters. So we've just always taught church, everybody come in, sit down, get out your hymnal, here we go. Well, and there's some of that, but it's different. A lot of times if you need to design a church to reach one group, it's not going to reach every group as effectively. Now in the church, we need all groups, and you can do some of these specialized things more in the small group. That's why, see, if you'd been to NAV Commerce 10 years ago, we would have been singing out of the hymnal, Great is Thy Faithfulness. See, I mean, that's what we would have sung, probably. We wouldn't have been doing these. Why don't we do the shorter songs, stand, clap, see, because this is what the younger generation is into. I'm not saying we ought to do away with all the old, because they're missing some things there too. Okay. They need strong, nurturing leadership. That clearly communicates goals, purposes. They need feedback, direction on the back. Busters are motivated by encouragement, respect, recognition, and praise. Tell people, if you're at an office and you've got some younger people coming in and they do anything right, encourage them. When they do something, encourage them. Hey, that was a good report you did. You're doing great. Now, if they're doing something wrong, they want to hear that too. But you're going to find, because they don't have the maturity. See, a very mature man can wait years for ultimate fulfillment. These people can't. They don't understand that. So try to be more encouraging and just letting. And there's a way that you can be an encourager to people. Recognize them, encourage them. Don't tell them what to do. Show them. See yourself as a coach and a cheerleader. They don't want to just be told. They want you to show them. They want that interaction with you. Give them activities so they can have fun. Many managers say this is their top priority. They want personal satisfaction out of everything they do. See, at one time, a man would work hard, but he'd have his fun somewhere else. But they want fun everywhere. They want their marriage to be fun. They want kids to be fun. They want the movies to be fun. They want work to be fun. Fun, mate.
Amen.
Right. We kind of like that. But they're very fun-oriented. They're cause-oriented. You give them something to believe in and what to be a part of, and they'll do anything for you. I'm not saying that they won't be committed, because you can lead some to some very, very deep commitments. Val, would you hand me the white sheet there, please, the big white one? And if you will, take one of these and we'll start it around. This will be interesting to you because I think it's a little bit of summary of where the different groups look at each other. See, they never classified people basically till the boomers came along. And then we've got, it's kind of like Jesus came along and here was A.D. and B.C. and all that. Well, the boomers, once we got the boomers, then we had to go back and call that generation something, and the one before and those that are coming afterwards. Look at the first one, the builders. And see, you know from that, those are the people that are born from 26 to 45. that age group think of the boomers as disrespectful, overly blunt. See, they were the people that were greedy. We're going after the money. We're going to build a good lifestyle, possessing warped values and leading unbalanced lives. They envy their education, their mastery of technology, and their drive for leadership. And the builders think of the busters as unusually immature, impatient, lacking a sense of ethics or morality, lazy, meddling. See, they won't know why. Emotionally unstable, yet they are hopeful that the busters will arrive at a thoughtful alternative value system to that of the boomers. See, the moms and dads who parented the boomers think, you didn't turn out too good. We hope the next generation, maybe they'll get their act together and turn out a little better than you did. It is assured that they are off to a slow start that may turn out better for it. Now, the boomers view the builders as rigid and inflexible, old-fashioned, too cautious for their own good, predictable, and generally out of touch with the real world. Concurrently, they respect their consistency, their pioneering spirit, and are intrigued by their traditional ethics and morality. And see, remember boomers view busters as selfish, impertinent, manipulative, aloof, passionless, and lacking in marketable skills and insight. Then again, they see a lot of themselves in this younger segment and hope to fine-tune some of their errant views they now possess. Now, the busters perceive the builders to be unwilling to change, wise, and so forth. But anyway, read the rest of that. And then, Val, hand me the blue sheet, too, if you will. I'm sorry I'm kind of tied down here. This is something that we sponsored a national BSU conference last summer in Norman. And one of the fellows did a message there that had some, and this had come out of some conferences and things that he had gleaned. But here are some good insights, I thought, about reaching baby boomers. Divorce, so we talked a little bit about that. Now, these kids grew up watching the Brady Bunch and Happy Days, but they didn't experience what they saw, the traditional family. They're the generation of abortion. They're the throwaway generation. And really eaten down in it, they wonder, am I really wanted? Some of them were thrown away, should I have been? They're the children of two working parents, the latchkey kids, no longer absentee dad. We've said some of that, TV, child care, double income families. They're the children of economic uncertainty. They were first to believe that they won't have as good a life economically as their parents have. They're the children of global distress, wars, famines, problems throughout the world. They're supposed to be overwhelmed and calloused. I know that's not spelled right. I circled that, but we didn't get it back corrected. They are in a survivor mode. They're the children of cultural chaos. There's a confusion of the male-female roles. That's why I'm finding with some of our students, you need to do some study in the area of masculinity. And that book on masculinity, he takes the six Hebrew words for man, and the whole book is built around that. It's very, very good. They're the first generation out of the women's movement. Now, they doubt fairly well until dating. They have a problem with that because they don't know how a man is supposed to act, how a woman is supposed to act necessarily. And they feel that they're cosmic janitors to clean up the mess the boomers created. Okay? The bibliography. And while you're getting this, then the yellow sheet, I want to mention a couple of books to you especially. I hope, and I was hoping if nothing else, one thing this would do is give you something to read and then that you'll do some reading in the area. If you were like I was, thank you, Val, like I was, I graduated from high school, I went to college, 5 years at Texas A&M, all men's school, go to class, go to the dorm, so study, go home Christmas. Then it's 5 years in seminary, then I start working on the campus and going over the dorms at night. I don't know a whole lot that's going on in the world. A lot of these things happen I didn't know about. Some of the things I've told you today you lived through, but you didn't know that either. And it really helps sometimes to do some reading. One of the books I want to especially recommend to you is all of these are good, but George Barna has a research group. I mean, they do surveys. Anything that you could read, I think you would really, really enjoy. This Frog in the Kettle is good, but this second one especially, The Invincible Generation. A lot of what I've given you today is out of that book, The Invincible Generation, about the Baby Busters. Probably the best book that's written on that. And then down about number five down is Joel Garreau or whatever that is, The Nine Nations of North America. That's one of the best books I've ever seen just on America. He says America is not 50 states, it's nine nations. Have any of you seen the last two or three days that Vermont is trying to keep a Walmart from coming in? Did any of you see that on TV? Well, see, if you had read this book, you'd know why. See, that's not a surprise to me that Vermont, because most people in Vermont have their PhDs. I mean, so many of them do. They have a wood-burning stove. They're from the East. They like their quaint little villages, and they don't want an 11-acre Walmart. Well, see, but can you imagine us trying to keep a Walmart from going in Oklahoma City? You think we live in the same nation. We don't, folks. I mean, there are nine nations in North America. That'll give you more insight into this nation than anything you'll ever read, I think. It's been out a number of years, but it's still worth reading. And then this Great Expectation by Landon Jones. That's one of the best books just on American culture. It's not a Christian book, but it's excellent. There's some articles on the back, two of this. Here are some. If you'll take one of these, and you can read this later, but just the difference between boomers and busters, and then the other. But one of the fellows on our staff a number of years ago took the book Baby Boom Believers, and he just summarized the book in just a little. So I thought, this might whet your appetite and make you want to read it. So we just reproduce this for you so you can take it and read it. You know, my desire would be that you just continue to learn about these groups. I think you'll find some things through here that will help you understand them. We want to lead them to deep commitment to Jesus Christ, and I am as convinced as I can be that this generation can be led to as deep a commitment to Jesus Christ as any generation we've ever seen. And since they have so many good characteristics, they want a good family, they want relationships, they want hands-on, they want to do something significant with their life. They're not just living to make money. There are a lot of good characteristics we can build on, I think, in helping lead them to a commitment to Jesus Christ.